Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Lender Legal. And what we're going to talk about today is Zillow and co-marketing, as well as some other interesting developments in Washington. So, you know, before I actually get into that, I just want to tell you a couple things. You guys can now follow me on Twitter, which I think will be a faster way sometimes when, you know, something breaks at the middle of a month. So if you ever want some kind of instant reaction to stuff, you could follow me at Lender Legal. So it's just, again, @LenderLegal on Twitter. And I also want to let you guys know that we're going to be putting out kind of a co-marketing assessment. No cost for it is if you want to kind of get an assessment of what you're doing in co-marketing and whether some of the risks we'll talk about today actually affect your organization. And if you're interested in receiving that, just respond to the email that you get for these conference calls, and you can... We'll send you that assessment. So just send it back to me, you know, akaaron@offickerman.com, which is the email you get for the call-ins for this, for the information. Just respond to that, and I will receive it and make sure you get on the list to receive that assessment. Kind of a couple of opening remarks there. Now, with respect to Zillow, I'm not going to leave you in suspense here. I completely and totally disagree with everything that was said in that video, okay, that all you guys saw. And let me start debunking it on a number of levels. First of all, listen, I'm always somewhat suspicious when I hear somebody say, I have it from the top, and, you know, you don't give me any details of who you have it from or anything like that. That doesn't say a lot to me, number one. Number two, I've been involved in investigations of stuff with I can't go into a lot of details, other than to tell you, having been in the room, like in the room, that's not what's going on, okay? So I could just tell you firsthand from somebody in the room, in those situations, talking about it with, sure, I can probably say the CFPB and other regulators, that is not something I've ever heard before, okay? And I'll leave it at that. I would also tell you that the rationale itself, putting all this other kind of background that I happen to have aside, makes no sense. So let's kind of say, let me repeat what was said in that video for a second. Essentially, the concept is that doing Zillow is per se a RESPA violation, allegedly, because by virtue of the fact that the realtor is putting the lender's name on the same site as them, or access point as them, it is an endorsement and therefore a referral. Okay, well, let's take this concept in a couple ways. Number one, from just a common sense standpoint, it makes no sense. Okay, you can only be in a position to refer if the person cares what you think. Right? I mean, if a strange man on the corner, you know, a homeless person on the corner sat there and said, you should use XYZ lender, who would care? Who would use them? Nobody, right? It would be useless. Well, how much difference is that than a total stranger? Remember, when you're doing Zillow or a lot of any of these internet sites, you know, what you're really getting, what you're seeing is a first instance contact to that realtor. The realtor's doing it to get first impression contact, right? They're not doing it because there's any relationship there. They don't know that realtor any more than they know a hole in the ground. So how's that realtor, from a common sense standpoint, in any position to give a referral, and why does anybody care? They don't know anything about that person. There's no transfer trust, as they say. That's the essence of a referral, is transfer trust, a recommendation of a person. There's specifically no recommendation, and there's specifically nothing that, even if there was, you would care about because you don't know the people. So from that standpoint, it makes no sense. Here's another thing. If, in fact, you accept the premise that merely being on a piece of advertising with somebody is an endorsement, that means, has to, I mean, this is just common logic, it must mean that every single piece of co-marketing is a referral, and every single piece of co-marketing that exists is, in fact, a violation of RESPA. So obviously we know that's not true, right? Or it sort of defeats the entire premise of what they're saying here. So I think, you know, you're probably sitting here saying, well, okay, well then there's got to be some shred of truth to this. And I think there's a shred, it's a small one, a shred of truth to this. And that is to say that could Zillow lead to a RESPA violation? Of course it could. Almost anything can lead to a RESPA violation. Okay, but let's be very, very clear. The concept that if you use Zillow, you violate RESPA, that is absolutely and totally, in my opinion, and completely wrong. And I think I've pretty much nailed that in terms of how clear I am on this point, right? I do not agree in any way, shape, or form that it's a per se violation of RESPA to use Zillow. And any statement that suggests that, I think, is incredibly flawed. I don't agree with the rationale that was expressed. It doesn't make any sense to me. And it's not consistent with anything that I've actually seen in practice being involved in investigations. And on top of that, if in fact it were true, there would be violations for all call marketing. So I think we know there aren't. And as a result, I wouldn't put a whole lot of weight in that statement that, you know, that was made in that video. To me, to be very candid, I think it's a scenario where if you've ever heard the saying, a little bit of knowledge is more dangerous than none at all, I think this may be a really good, you know, illustration of that. So what do I think is important when you're dealing with Zillow or any of these leads? I think the key is to have control. Like, have I seen investigations where people have done things wrong with Zillow and other co-marketing, by the way? Yes, of course. So, like, what are some of the lessons you can learn from that? Well, number one, control the money. Here's what I mean by that. I've seen things done wrong with, we'll just call them internet sites. I hate to just limit it to Zillow because I've seen this happen with others, where people do things that, or you have loan officers do things that you did not intend, that nobody intended. So I've seen, for example, where there's accounts, they create multiple accounts for one name, paying the realtor 50% of the time, 4 and 5 and 6 times per month, which even I can do the math, that's 300%, which is pretty clearly a RESPA violation, right? Because now you're just paying the realtor. I've also seen at times where, you know, you're paying more than your fair share. So I don't know if it's still the case like this. Zillow, I know in particular, used to be able to go up to 90%. I wouldn't pay 90%, okay? I'd pay 50%. And you split the leads with them, and everybody's happy. If there are multiple, you know, realtors on it, I think that you, in aggregate, don't want to pay more than 50%, and you could split it between a couple, I said realtors, I meant lenders. If there were multiple lenders, I think the lenders all want to take their fair share, right, which is, but at no point should be more than 50% from the realtor. So in other words, if you had three lenders, or let's say two lenders, and one realtor, the two lenders go 25-25, the realtor goes 50. I think that's how you would design it, right? Obviously, I know in many of these cases, you can't have multiple people or you don't know who's on it, which is going to certainly lead to something else that I want to talk about, which is that you want to have written agreements with the realtors of the do's and don'ts, right? So just, this doesn't have to be a 26-page legal document. It doesn't have to be a 2-page legal document. It could be, frankly, I mean, it's not my preference, but, you know, in the whole vein of better something than nothing, it could be an email, right, where you just address kind of understanding. If it's an email, make sure it's the same email. Make sure you write it and somebody in compliance writes it, not necessarily the loan officer for obvious reasons. But the point is you want to have something that really clarifies what's being done, what's being paid, what the terms are. If they're lying and, you know, not being honest with you, at least you've got something to document if there is ever this case that, hey, they did something on their own and you can't hold me responsible because there was no way I could have known about it, right? So I think that's, you know, documenting what the understanding and the terms are. Ideally, that's a one-page contract kind of thing where you each sign. That's how I would do it. It's a standard type of thing. That's what I would do. I think the other thing you also want to do is you want to have policies and procedures for this. Again, it sounds like I'm talking about a lot of stuff. This is pretty simple stuff. It's a couple of pages. you say what you can do, what you can't do. The other thing, you know, and you kind of lay that internally, so your own staff understands that no, you can't pay a realtor four times 50%, you know, every month. That's not permissible. And you can't have secondary deals. This is another one we see a lot, where the realtor and the lender are on Zillow together, and yet there's a second deal that says, I'm going to call my people, you call your half, I'll refer my half to your half, you do the same. That's good, right? There's a quid pro quo there, which under the current impression of the CFPB is a RESPA violation. So, you know, if the deal is we're just going to, you know, do the 50%, you know, we're going to pay half, you're going to pay half, then that's the deal, and you leave it at that, and there's nothing else. And that's how I would, you know, you just want to make sure that that's all clearly buttoned up. The other thing that you want to do is you want to make sure as you do these situations that, you create a scenario where you've done some level of, due diligence. I hate to use that term, but it's the best one I can think of at the moment, at least an assessment, right, of these different marketing vehicles. What I mean is it should not be a free-for-all, right? People do what they do, and I don't pay any attention to it, and it's the Wild West, and we'll deal with it later. No, I believe what you want to do is if somebody wants to use something, it has to be pre-approved. So if you want to use Zillow or Redfin or any number of these that are out there, whatever it might be, there's all kinds of different gyrations of this. I think another one's Mortgage Builder, and there's a bunch of these out there, right? Test them out. And the other thing, don't rely upon any of these companies, whether it's a CRM system or whatever it is, for them to say, oh, we're compliant. That in a quarter will get you 25 cents. That's not to, again, put any of these companies down. Many of them very well might be compliant. But you can't rely on them to do that, okay? And there might be some companies who are more reputable than others, but it's also not even a question of reputation, it's a question of skill, right? They may not have the skill to make that assessment, especially they may not have the skill to make the assessment in how you particularly plan to use it, right? Because, you know, if you're using it a slightly different way or for a different means than it's intended, then there might be a problem. So I think you have to take how you're going to use it, evaluate that with counsel, and then you'll know exactly whether what you're doing is, you know, contextually is compliant. Then another really big point, I think, is ensuring that you have control over the money. A lot of times where the problems come from is that lenders reimburse loan officers for what they're doing, but they don't know exactly what is being done. So in other words, you get an invoice, or not even an invoice, something, say, oh, I spent $500 a month on buying leads. Okay, here's $500. And, you know, some invoice may or may not be attached to it. And even if it is, by the way, it's being done by accounting who's not paying any attention to it from a compliance standpoint. I think you need to know what the money is going for, who it's going for, where, when, and why. Whether you have some deal in the back that involves the compensation where you can try to essentially recoup your that money is it kind of a different discussion. I'm not saying you can't do that. Depending, again, it's kind of a whole other discussion. But my point is that, you know, having control of the money will allow you to detect whether things are being done wrong. In almost every case where I've seen a compliance violation involving the use of co-marketing, it's a scenario where the lender literally had no idea what was going on because they were just writing a $500 check or a $1,000 check to the loan officer every month. They have no idea what it was actually being used for, who was actually being paid. They don't know any of that information. And, you know, the result is that the regulators come in and see this problem, which, you know, is pretty easily discovered. And at the end of the day, you know, they're saying, okay, well, you know, now there's a problem. And why didn't you catch it? And you say, well, how was I supposed to know? And they said, well, you weren't doing anything to check it, right? And, you know, listen, one other thing I want to just mention here is that a lot of times where me and other lawyers, they have policies and procedures, I know and I can understand why people sort of roll their eyes. Like, do I need a policy and procedure for everything? And a little bit. Here's why. The policy and procedure, I will be the first one to concede. If you're not following it, having it doesn't do anything for you, right? It's not going to Well, and it's not true. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't save you, okay? But I want to give you another way to look at it, which is how I look at it. Assume there's a problem, and you don't have any policies and procedures, and you don't do anything. Well, now that's a situation where you just don't care. And that may not be how you feel, but that's how it looks to a regulator, right? You didn't do anything. You didn't have policies, you had procedures, you had no controls in place. You just let these guys, and that's the perception, right? As opposed to a scenario where maybe something happens and you say, look, I had policies and procedures, and I realize these can file, but at least, you know, you did something to try to control a difficult situation. And it may not be the thing that just gets you out of trouble, but not having it is almost adding more fuel to the fire, which is the last thing you want to do when you have a problem is add more fuel to the fire, right? So that's why having this system is important. It is not going to be a get-out-of-jail-free card. It is not going to protect you 150%. What it will do is avoid adding fuel to the fire. And so I think those things are very important. Again, kind of sort of to recap this discussion a little bit is, what's going on with look, Zillow, like all co-marketing, you can do it, and you can do it lawfully. Like anything, if you do it wrong, if there's no oversight, if there's no compliance, if there's no control, and you let the animals run the zoo, so to speak, then yeah, you could have a problem. You could have a problem with anything, though, if you let that happen, right? And you probably will. So I really would discount strongly the video that says, because you're doing it, you're going to get a visit from the CFPB. I don't think that's true at all, for all the reasons I said today. So I hope that gives everybody a chance to breathe a sigh of relief. And, if you have any questions, like I said, you could send the assessment to us, and we'll get back to you. And you kind of look specifically at what you're doing and whether there's any risks or anything with that. We'll get back to you on it. So this sort of bleeds into the second part of it, of this discussion, which is what is going on with marketing and co-marketing in the CFPB, right? So last time we visited, a little while ago, PHH was sitting there. We didn't know it was going to happen. And since then, the circuit court has granted an in-bank hearing on PHH. What that means is the ruling that currently we were all celebrating essentially doesn't, at least for the moment, exist anymore. It could be affirmed, it could be changed, it could be reversed, anything can happen, but effectively it is not existing at this moment. So at this moment, Cordray could only be fired for cause, okay? And the RESPA rules and everything that the court decided on in the PHH case didn't happen. Now, here's what I will tell you that has going on also with the case moving forward, is there's three ways the court has, there's basically three questions that full court has decided to, has asked the lawyers to brief. The first is obviously on RESPA, what basically is the controlling interpretations here. Second, whether the CFPB is unconstitutional because it vests too much power in the director who can only be fired for cause. And third, which was a very interesting issue that I want to point out, is whether the administrative law judge that decided the case initially was unconstitutionally ruling on the case because he was not appointed by Congress. He was an agent of the CFPB, an employee, if you will. So those are the three issues. Now, just so you understand also, the court, which was 2-1, the panel that decided the PHH case was a 2-1 panel, and I say 2-1, in other words, that's how the decision went, and the two judges that were ruled in favor of PHH were actually Republican. The full court is actually comprised of a 7-4 majority. So 7-4 majority being Democratic. So you have a really different split there, if you will. So that's interesting because the politics are obviously going to change at a full panel. And why that's also kind of interesting is that you have to consider the fact that when they're ruling on this case, they have different options. They could, number one, say that, we're just going to rule on RESPA. We're not going to get to the issue of constitutionality at all. Remember, the dissenting judge in the opinion in PHH, the Democrat, that judge said, listen, we don't actually have to deal with the Constitution at all in this. We could just rule on RESPA. We don't have to deal with it. And that's something the court could do. Number two, the court could obviously could rule that the ALJ was unconstitutional. Now, you know, if they did that, essentially what happens is PHH never happened. In other words, the $6 million fine that got appealed, that never happened. Nothing ever happened. And the whole case goes back to the CFPB, remanded to have a new trial with an ALJ appointed by Congress. Talk about sidestepping the case. We would literally get no authority out of it. The opinion that was issued a couple months ago, that wouldn't have happened either. So it would leave RESPA sort of in a mired state of confusion, and we would still not know about the constitutionality of the CFPB vis-a-vis Cordray having, the removal power only being for Cordray limited to for cause. That could be, in my opinion, probably the worst outcome for the industry because we would know nothing. You know, one way or another, however they determine RESPA, at least we get some ruling on that. The other thing is that, you know, we would leave the whole state of the industry in flux with respect to the CFPB's authority. So, for example, if I had a case pending towards enforcement or a settlement agreement or, you know, enforcement of a subpoena or something, you know, the fact is you always have the opportunity to go to court and say, hey, you know, this is, you know, this, the CFPB doesn't have authority for this. So that sort of leaves that out there. Now, what the court will do, you know, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I don't think it's going to be decided anytime soon. And just to sort of add some theater to this is the fact that now, all of a sudden, we've learned as of, three days ago, that the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, has actually requested the ability to file an amicus brief with the court in the PHH case to defend PHH's position. So just think about this, okay? We have the U.S. Department of Justice that's actually going to take the position in favor of a litigant against the federal government and the CFPB. And that happened a couple days ago. So, I mean, you could see where this is getting very interesting. Obviously, the reasons behind it are that Trump wants to fire Cordray, and Trump wants to have that power to do so. At this particular moment, he doesn't. you know, obviously, that's why DOJ is taking the position they do. This leads also to another couple interesting points just to think about, which are, and I mean, this isn't just philosophical. This might have some practical impact for people on the call, depending on whatever situations they may have. But for example, you know, think about it. Who does a lot of the fair lending cases for the CFPB? It's the Department of Justice. Well, DOJ is clearly marching to a different drum right now, right? They're going to do what they do. It's not going to be the let's hold hands and sing kumbaya, which has been the relationship between DOJ and the CFPB pretty much ever since the CFPB started. Now there's, you could see a scenario where some, where you know, DOJ says, yeah, we're not going to prioritize those types of cases right now. We'll get to that. And we promise we will. We just got to do some other stuff first. I'll call you next year. Don't call me, though. I'm a little busy. I'll get back to you, I promise. Like, you could see that happening, right? So it's just an interesting thing. Will that happen? I don't know. But think about it. To the extent, you know, you're worried about DOJ, you may be in an investigation. I'm not going to say you can count on this, but it's worth consideration of the situation you may be in. Like, if I was waiting right now for a referral to DOJ or was worried about one from the CFPB, I'm not saying I wouldn't, but, you know, put that into your think tank there, because it's certainly, I mean, DOJ is outright arguing against them in federal court. So that's kind of an interesting situation we haven't seen much of. Now, where this is all boiling down to, obviously, again, this is my understanding of situations, is there's the bills relating to the CFPB. Actually, this is more than understanding. I think it's pretty common knowledge at this point, that were supposed to be introduced in March and April, have because of the prioritization of healthcare. Now these will be introduced sometime, probably this summer, and I am a little suspicious of that as well, because one thing you know is that, you know, one little crisis happens, and with the limited time Congress is in session in summers and how quickly, you know, that can pass, it's very foreseeable, I think, that now summer will become fall. So we may not see any bills relating to the CFPB for some time. And so I think for the moment, you know, it is pretty much status quo. I do believe that we will see a diminished level of aggressive enforcement by the CFPB in an aggressive way, in terms of sort of cutting edge, groundbreaking, because I think what they're going to be trying to do is garnering political support and therefore finding, quote unquote, good victims to make the case that the agency is needed and protects the public. So I think we will be seeing a lot of that while we're sort of waiting for these other things to flush out. So again, thank you for everybody. I hope I gave you some clarity on my views on the Zillow case and sort of what's going on overall. For anybody that may have missed it and signed on late, you can now follow me at Twitter at @LenderLegal. The Twitter handle is @LenderLegal. And again, if you do want to have an assessment of what you're doing with Zillow and whether your co-marketing actions are right or creating some potential risk for you, just send back an email to the invites for these calls, and we'll get it, and I'll make sure assessment goes out to you. They will probably be going out on Monday of next week. So thanks, everybody. I hope you have a great weekend, and I hope I was able to help you breathe easy at least that you're not getting a letter from the CFPB just because you do some co-marketing on leads. Thanks a lot. Have a nice weekend.